Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo, built to last, designed to impress.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, join us in Galway's Town Hall Theatre on Saturday, 6th of April, Killarney's INEC on Saturday, the 13th of April, and in Belfast's Waterfront Studios on Saturday, the 27th of April. Tickets from venues or at mcd.ie.
The three of them would have been not just problematic in terms of the peace process, but they would have been considered, I suppose, people who would have had the capability and ability to cause real issues. It was 10 years and 3 months. That's how long this case was the justice system. 10 years and 3 months. It is the longest ever terror trial in Northern Ireland's legal history.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Two Republicans, Colin Duffy and Henry Fitzsimons, have been acquitted of terrorism charges following a long-running trial at Belfast Crown Court. Earlier, their co-accused, Alex McCrory, was also acquitted in the MI5 bugging case. So how did this trial take 10 years in the courts? And what is the fallout from their acquittals? Did MI5 succeed in infiltrating the new IRA while the old order was caught up in the case and on strict bail conditions? Or was the decade-long case a fiasco for Public Prosecution Service? Today, I'm talking to Belfast Telegraph's crime correspondent, Alison Morris, about MI5 bugs and the long-running case. This is Crime World, a podcast from sundayworld.com. So just start you off with asking you how you're feeling for the listeners.
I'm a little bit ropey, but yeah. Yeah, but well, I have just munched stodge and dodgy chicken fillet rolls.
You didn't have foie gras on crackers?
Nah. I was knocking on fried chicken and hot sauce and hoping that would cure me of my ills. But
and does it cure you now?
No, probably not.
No, there was a time I used to be able to have a breakfast roll.
Yeah.
And that was it, and a cup of coffee, and I was right as rain. But
well, in your 20s, you can skip into work after 2 hours sleep, can't you? But yeah, it's an all different thing at my age. It's a good kip I need, never mind anything else. I need to go sleep.
But did you? Was it worth it?
It was worth it. It was a great night out.
Yeah, well, that's it. Belfast is always hopping, isn't it? I mean, a Thursday night in Dublin can be quiet.
I prefer a Thursday night out. Saturday night, you get all the amateur drinkers out, you know, the ones who don't know how to handle themselves. Whereas Thursday, it's a professional drinking night out, I find.
And there's no point in wasting
your
day.
You only meet like-minded
off
people on a Thursday night
with a hangover, isn't it? It's quite a kind place in here, though, for, you know, a hangover. It's quiet and, you know, you have the river outside and
yes,
it's
it is
serene or something.
Yeah, they're very tolerant of my
lots of coffee machines. Anyway, just thought we'd just touch on that before we move to more pressing matters. So, I'm going to ask you, first of all, like, who is Colin Duffy and Harry Fitzsimons?
Who are they? What's their background?
Well, there was actually three people involved in this case. So there was Colin Duffy, there was Harry Fitzsimmons, and there was Alex McCrory. So the three of them would all have been considered very senior veteran Republicans, Republicans of some vintage. Colin Duffy, Alex McCrory, and Harry Fitzsimmons have all either served time as members of the Provisional IRA or been, in Colin Duffy's case, charged with Provisional IRA activity, but then later either acquitted or found not guilty when it comes to court.
Have they been in and out of prison throughout their lives?
Yeah, yeah. And Alec McCrory was in prison when he was very young. I think he was a blanket man and part of the protests. Harry Fitzsimmons was involved in a very high profile kidnapping case of a guy called Bobby Toll. There's, you know, there's a lot of... they would be very well known, and there would have been Republicans of quite some standing. And so in terms of this kind of activity, I suppose, for the police at the time, they would have been, you know, people who they would definitely have wanted to get off the streets and get into prison.
So they were provos, and they sort of, after the peace process, moved on into dissident
activity. We now see a change in those dissident groups. And I always say this, because you can see from the age of the people being arrested who are in their 20s and 30s, so they were not old enough to have ever... been members of the Provisional IRA. Mm. But if you go way back to like the start of that sort of dissident Republican movement, and you look at the real IRA and people like Michael McCavitt and all that, they were disgruntled ex-professionals who were just thought that it wasn't the right time for a ceasefire, that they were against aspects of the peace process. Many of them, I think, stayed after the Good Friday Agreement, but then couldn't align themselves with signing up to policing and went after that. So there's various different reasons. So the three of them would have been not just problematic in terms of the peace process, but they would have been considered, I suppose, people who would have had the capability and ability to cause real issues for the security forces and, I suppose, in terms of trying to maintain any kind of sense of normality around this place.
We're looking at Pierce McCauley's death earlier this week and having a chat about him, and I was wondering, you know, which came first, sort of the political or the violence? Was he a violent man who was attracted to the IRA because of what they allowed him to do? You know, it is a big question. I don't know whether it's time yet to sort of consider that.
Or I honestly do think, I mean, I have thought, I've met so many people who were involved and went to prison, and some for like really horrendous acts of violence. But when you meet them and you speak to them, you think, had there not been a conflict here, that person would never have seen the inside of a cell. You know, there would never have been an inside of court, because they're not people who would be naturally disposed, I suppose, to that kind of violent activity, but they did become victims of the circumstances they live in. And then I have also met people, and this is a much smaller group, who I always think, you'd have just been a maniac anyway. And all that happened here was that gave political cover to your activities. But I mean, you'd have been in prison regardless, because clearly just a very violent person. And Pierce McCauley, I got that sense from him that he was someone who quite enjoyed that aspect of it. And then we can see that, because when he no longer had the cover of political violence, he turned to a domestic abuser and was incredibly violent towards his ex-wife. I would put, you know, I mean, in my very, and I haven't had very many, I did speak to Colin Duffy. I interviewed him after he was acquitted in terms of the attack in Massarine, where two soldiers were killed outside the army base in Antrim. And he's, you know, wouldn't be someone like who I would say like Pierce McCauley in terms, you know, he actually has quite a happy and settled home life, you know, he would be. But, and with the other ones as well, I do get the impression they're very different kind of characters. But for the PSNI at the time, and especially for MI5, and MI5 were involved in this case, as they are in a lot of these cases, these would have been people who they would have definitely wanted to target. And as you know, as I'm sitting here trying to dissect it, because you got this massive big ruling and you have to try then and get, you know, a news story out and an analysis out. And then I always think it's good to take time and pause and then try and do something more in depth, you know, get right into it. And when I think about that, I don't think it's too tinfoil hat to suggest that getting these boys offside, whether they were ever prosecuted or not. And remember, and people will go, this sounds insane, but from the day that they were arrested until Thursday, whenever they were, the final two were acquitted, because McCrory had already had his case dismissed last year, it was 10 years and 3 months. That's how long this case was the justice system. 10 years and 3 months. It is the longest ever terror trial in Northern Ireland's legal history. The PPS are today sending out statements defending their role in it and saying a lot of those delays were not caused by them. They were caused by
first of all, the defence applications, and people are entitled to defend themselves, you know, against these charges. And they had a very, very robust defence, I have to say. They really, you know, their defence teams went through every aspect of this and picked every part of it apart. And you could see that in the judgment. But also, there was unavoidable delays. So delays that we all know about, such as COVID. So COVID delayed this trial for a period of time. And also there was a real tragic event.
It doesn't excuse 10 yeah. years.
Nothing does. There was a really tragic event as well. Colin Duffy's son died in a car accident, his teenage son, and that clearly, obviously delayed it for a while. But that doesn't excuse the 10 years and 3 months. I'll actually have a look at what the PPS are saying. Is that basically most of this was not our fault, is what they're saying. It's a long-running case which arrived at the Crown Court in 2016. So they're arrested in December 2013 and they're remanded. This then rattled around the lower courts for several years. Then in 2016, it was sent to the Crown. And they're saying the reasons that it has taken this time to reach an outcome are varied and largely, I'd say, the control of the PPS. And there has been no undue delay on the part of the prosecution. They're saying a lot of these cases are very complicated for the judiciary to manage. Our justice system is just a joke. Like, I mean, it's just shambles. I often report on cases that are in the courts for 5 and 6 years, you know, before they reach an outcome. But even by the state of our courts, 10 years and 3 months.
So is it
no prosecution, by the way?
Did it rattle around those lower courts for so long because of discovery of documents? It's all really based on recordings, isn't it?
It's very, very much. It's one of those MI5 cases that was based on recordings. And this is, I suppose, is one of the really interesting things. So, you know, we have a case at the minute, the RBSU, and that's based on recordings that were inside properties that were hired by Dennis McFadden, the MI5 agent who infiltrated this group. These recordings were placed along a path in a public park. They were like buried in the ground and, you know,
these
trees.
Ones in this case?
Yeah, there was 14 listening devices.
Right.
That were placed in a park that obviously assumed that, you know, and watched under surveillance and felt this is where these people walk and talk. And you are a crime reporter, as am I. And often I go and meet sources and the first thing they'll say is, leave your phone in the car and come on, take a walk with me. And I find myself completely unsuitably shooed walking through all manner of places because people are very suspicious and they would rather speak to you in the open air where they think they're not being bugged. But they were. These bugs did come from a public park. The problem was the quality of them wasn't great. There's a lot of background noise in them as well. With these MI5 cases, what we find is MI5 Geller, they went a couple of days later, they take all their listening devices out, they download all the audio, they give it then over to the police, and then they destroy all the original copies of it so nothing can ever be checked or traced. They do that quite a lot in all these cases. And I was in court one of the day, one of the MI5 operatives was given evidence. They refused to answer questions. So they say,
for security reasons,
I cannot answer that question on the grounds of national security. And that's their stock answer. So it's difficult to cross-examine them. And that helps the defence, let's face it, because they're not very compelling witnesses if they're just saying, I can't answer that on the grounds of national security.
So why were MI5 wanting so desperately to listen to these three men in a park that they sort of what was going to be rough recording?
A few days before this, or the day before the bugging in the park, there had been a shooting in Ardoyne. So, I mean, as I had said this week, this has been going on for so long that the circumstances around this now seem like something from a bygone time because there was a parade dispute. There are no parade disputes. Parade disputes have all been more or less settled. This was go right back to the time when I would have spent my summers standing at riots, you know, year in, year out. So there was a parade dispute. The Parades Commission had banned an Orange Order march going past Ardoyne, which was always a flashpoint. That was always where the riots and trouble would have taken place. As a result of this, loyalists set up a permanent sort of 24-hour camp at Tredale. And Tredale is sitting on a roundabout facing its Ardoyne. On the other side is the loyalist Woodvale and Shankill. And they were there constantly. So there was a static police presence. The police were there constantly, obviously guarding this because it's on an interface. It's very volatile. And it seems to be whoever the gunmen were. And, you know, we don't know because all three of these people have been found not guilty. There was never any suggestion that Alan McCrory or Duffy were the gunmen, but they had charged High Fitzsimons with attempted murder, which indicate they believed he was one of the gunmen. He seemed to have been watching the shift patterns. So every 10 or 12 hours or whatever, the shift would change and those cops would go off and new ones would arrive and they would come from the direction of either the city centre or Tennant Street Station and drive up the Curran Road. The attackers, in this case, the new IRA gunmen, had built a platform out of scaffolding behind. There's a big high sort of peace wall almost that divides that interface. They'd built a scaffolding behind that, which gives them perfect cover but also a vantage point whenever this convoy was coming up. So there was two AK-47 rifles used in this attack. One jammed, so it didn't fire a single shot. The other one fired 14 shots and all three vehicles were hit. The last vehicle, that pierced through whatever armour it had, there was no one hurt. I think obviously you'd be quite shocked if you were inside a vehicle and someone started shooting at you, but there was no one physically hurt. And this is what this investigation was about. Clearly they'd been bugging them for much longer than that. But at this,
so nobody was hurt or injured in that?
No, nobody was hurt or injured. The gunmen then ran off. One of the AK-47s was found in a burnt out car in Ardoyne, and the other one was found, I think, a day later in a flower bed, where they'd just been thrown by the gunmen as they ran away. And that in itself, there wasn't that many AK-47s knocking around at the time. You know, usually you would take those things with you. You wouldn't leave them behind.
But, no, indeed.
Yeah.
So it was a shooting at the security services, and obviously the new IRA, their whole focus was really on security services. Yep. And trying to do as much damage as they could.
It would appear that maybe that there had been bugging for a long time for intelligence reasons. So a lot of these buggings take place, and we never know the places have been bugged because it'll never be brought up in court and they'll be using evidence. A lot of it's intelligence gathering. It's not, because a lot of times it doesn't meet the evidential standard, which is what one of the problems were in this case, you know, and that's what the judge had to examine in this case. It doesn't meet the standard of for prosecution, but it is obviously useful intelligence for MI5, for PSNI, for Special Branch, for whoever's using it. It seems that they didn't put these bugs in place because there'd been a shooting the night before. They'd clearly been in place for some time. They'd obviously been monitored and saying, this is where these people walk and talk. But after the shooting, there was obviously a decision to remove those bugs and examine. So they're saying there was a meeting between these three men. There was very grainy CCTV.
Meeting in the aftermath
the day after the attack.
Okay.
Discussing basically what went wrong.
Yeah.
With the attack. They said the three of them arrived. There was using number plate reading, cameras, and also cell phone analysis. They had put Harry Fitzsimons' car and his phone in and around the Lurgan area. But there was then the defence raised a dispute over how could you prove, given how grainy the CCTV was and the fact that the number plate was partially blocked, that it was the same car. I think the car was a Lexus, and at one point there's a very surreal evidence given by the manager of the Lexus dealership somewhere who shows up and is shown a picture of Harry Fitzsimons' car and a picture of the car in the CCTV. I went, are they the same car? And he's like, I don't know. That looks like a different model than that. You know, this is how, you know, into the weeds this case got. And then a lot of it was based on voice analysis. And voice analysis is not an exact science. It's, you know, it's someone's opinion. And so the voice analysis in this case was disputed. The guy who carried out the voice analysis was basically discredited as a witness, because what they had said was he was aware who the three people were before he started listening to it, and that's not best practice. Best practice, apparently, in voice analysis, and I feel like I know a lot more about this now than I did, is that you're not told. You're just basically saying, suspect A, suspect B, suspect C, here's a recording of their voice in different circumstances. Now here's the recording that we have. Can you say that those three, instead he knew who they were beforehand, which was part of it. It wasn't great quality. That's why Alex McCrory, once that voice analysis was thrown out as evidence, and there was a whole voyeur hearing into that, and that was dismissed as evidence.
When was that?
That was in 2022. And once that happened,
stuff already get argued in the lower courts before it made it to the higher courts?
There was the progression through the court was, so the charge in December 2013. The committal papers were issued, they're saying, in December 2014, so that took a full year. After there was contested committal proceedings, so their solicitors contested that, and then it was returned. That all happens in the lower courts. So then it's returned to the Crown Court, and that took until March 2016. Then in April 2016, the defence entered no bill application, basically saying there's not enough evidence, this case shouldn't proceed. And the judge gave a ruling on that in January 2017. So there we have another year in the courts. A trial date was then fixed for February 2016 to start in October. So it was expected to start in October 2017. There was a load of mentions, there was bail hearings, there was legal representations of all kinds. The trial eventually started on the 11th of March 2019.
Right.
That was meant to be the first day. It only managed to last until June. Then it was paused over the summer due to the death of Colin Duffy's son. Nobody could have avoided that. You know, that's a tragedy of nobody's make, you know, it wasn't anyone's fault, either prosecution or the defence. The trial was to resume, but was postponed again and didn't recommence until January 2020. At which point we're, you know, 7 years on then from the actual attack.
And coming into COVID.
Yeah, and that continued till March 2020 when we know what happened then. COVID happens and so the whole trial process starts again. It resumed again in November 2020, and there was a load of applications for the evidence to be excluded. That was all to do with the voice recognition. That was in March 2021, and there was a ruling given out in September 2022. Nothing happened between those times, by the way. Mm. And then the prosecution case closed in October 2022, and there was another defence application. That was in March 2023, and that's when Alec McCrory's case was thrown out. And obviously then...
this one.
The ruling is... So it was the most complicated... Some of it was utter nonsense, and some of it was obviously valid, but...
But why didn't the trial, when it got going initially, just keep going until it ended? Like, why does it keep
chopping?
There
was numerous other... Well, it happens in a lot of these cases. It's such complicated evidence, and a lot of it was being challenged. So then, if you challenge the prosecution's voice analysis person, well, then you have to get another voice analysis expert, which the defence at that stage, I think it was Harry Fitzsimons' defence at that stage, which was Philip Rain's solicitors, they got another person who came along. Then the judge himself, there was an application for the judge to recuse himself because he'd heard so much of the evidence up until this point. They said that somebody else should make the final decision. That was denied. The judge himself, Mr. Justice O'Hara, he also spent quite a considerable time listening to these tapes. The question was, do they say... can you hear the words Collie or Colin and Harry being said on these tapes? Some of them said no, and their transcript showed that they couldn't, without a doubt, say their names. And then the judge took him home and listened to himself, and he said that he was warned that one person listened to this, you'll hear what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't rely on his own hearing in terms of that. So it was, in the end, it came down to the voice analysis was just of such poor quality, and the experts in this case messed up. They didn't follow proper procedure.
So how many days? You probably don't know that off the top of your head. Did it sit?
I have absolutely no idea. Like the cost of it will be...
I mean, the cost would be what?
Millions. Millions and millions. I mean, I mean, someone said...
three different...
someone pulled
defendants.
A figure to me of 10 million. And yeah. I don't know whether... it'll be a while for the prosecution will even be able to calculate that to tell us, because obviously all the costs of it...
Yeah, you'd have to work out how many days it actually sat. You have three different legal teams.
All the preparation and everything that goes on in relation to the build-up to that. You have three legal teams, and that'll be, you know, there was two firms of solicitors. There'll be three senior barristers, three junior barristers. All the experts that all have to be paid as well for all their evidence. All the to and fro in the court time, and obviously then the prosecution barristers. So I would say, I mean, the only thing I could find that was even remotely similar is the Stuart Brothers Supergrass trial, which also ended no convictions. It cost $11.5 million. That was quite a few years ago, you know. Prices have changed.
There's a few lawyers making some money up here, isn't there?
God, yeah. I mean, it's. I suppose there's only a handful who are able to operate at that high level. You know, there wouldn't be every barrister making that kind of money. There's only a few that are capable of doing these big, very complicated trials. But, you know, I suppose if we're going to analyse it, if the idea was to get these people prosecuted, well, then it was a complete and utter failure. One of the defence solicitor for McCrory and Duffy, who's a guy called Peter Corrigan, he says this case was always doomed to failure. It was an opportunity. The prosecution case was simply trying to make the glove fit, which I love as an analogy, because that O.J. Simpson, you know, they were trying to make the evidence fit these people rather than the evidence actually pointing to these people. I'm not sure if that was the idea. Well, then it failed. If the idea was to take these three boys out of the way and keep them out of the way and allow people like Dennis McFadden to then infiltrate that organisation to the point where it was so compromised that its entire leadership or alleged leadership ended up behind bars. Well, then maybe intelligence services consider that
a success
because the role of MI5 is not to get prosecutions. Remember, the role of MI5 is just to disrupt that kind of activity.
When was McFadden embedded in the organisation? So 2013, this case dates back to, and those three would have been the most senior figures, yeah? So,
well, yes, and we bear in mind that these three are not convicted of this, so I'm saying they would have been alleged to be the most senior figures. The organisation, the NRA, was only formed in 2012, so it was a merger group, so it took what was left of the real IRA, which had never, you know, after the Umma bomb, the real IRA never really, I suppose, had any real impact or support, but it took what was left of the real IRA, a group called Republican Action Against Drugs, which was just a vigilante group carrying out like punishment style, you know, paramilitary style shootings in Derry and Strabane, and what they called independent Republicans from Tyrone, which were people who would have again been quite disgruntled professionals. I'm told that the disgruntled Republicans from Tyrone are the only ones that had any weapons at that stage. They were the boys that brought the gear with them. That quite quickly broke up because of egos, too many chiefs, too many bosses, not enough Indians and at all. So they took their ball, and in this case, their ball was all the weaponry and went home. And what was left then became the new IRA. Obviously, that was 2012. These boys are arrested in 2013, so right in the early days of it. And after that, we see McFadden playing a bigger role in terms of starting off doing what were justice campaigns he infiltrated himself into the middle of. When they were trying to form this merger group, they also tried to get ONH, Oglan Ahern, to join in with it too, and the Continuity IRA, the idea that Tony Catney, who's now dead, had, he's again ex-professional, was, will form a big super group, you know, that'll be like the professional IRA. But there were suspicions already among them. Catney was said to have been named as a special branch informer in the tapes that were stolen from Castlereagh in 2002 by the IRA.
At the same time, you had down in the south, you had, Alan Ryan. Mm-hmm. And his activities, he was putting the heavy on a lot of drug gangs. He was, you know, seen as, in the south, he was seen as a real leader of men for the real IRA, a kind of a young, very enthusiastic hero, as some of them thought, that took on everybody. He took on the big boys as well as the small boys. And he was murdered himself in 2012. And in the aftermath of that, with the formation of this new supergroup, there was chaos down south as well, because there was accusations that they had pocketed the money, they hadn't sent it up north, and there was a number of kneecappings, and then some of the criminals down south maybe took care of things for them.
Yeah. Well, what also I remember when Alan Ryan was killed at his funeral, a lot of the people from who would go on to form this merger group all went down to that funeral, very, very senior Republicans. And I spoke to some of them afterwards and they were horrified by what they'd seen, because, you know, these would be people who'd be Republicans, I suppose, in the purest sense of that, you know, in that armed militant state. And they all live quite frugal lives. Most of them probably either doing quite low paid jobs or surviving basic on benefits a lot of the time. And they arrived down in Dublin, and what these looked like was, you know, the UDA Space Boys from the 90s. They were all in Range Rovers with the tattoos and the, you know, the muscles and the sunbed tans and the t-shirts two sizes too small and the whole shebang. And they were like, what on earth is going on down here? Clearly, this is an enterprise which is more about making money for the people who are involved, making profiles, trying to turn them into some sort of, you know, celebrities almost. And they were not a bit pleased by what they witnessed, I think, at those funerals. So
would Duffy have been at that funeral, do you think?
I am pretty sure that Duffy was at that funeral. I'd need to go back and look
through.
They
made a show of the funeral that, you know, they were all united and that there was no problems in the background. But, you know, you could see from after it that there were big problems.
And I don't think they even realised how big the problems were until the funeral. And then I think there was, you know, someone has went, right, we need to investigate what these boys are actually at, you know. Obviously, the role of, even when you go back to professional times, the role of people in the South, it was organisation, it was money, it was making money, either through robberies or fundraising and setting it up. And it was also helping with things like drug, you know, with gun smuggling and all of those sort of things. And then they show up and these boys are living, you know, lifestyles that make them look more like members of a drug cartel than
they
anything
totally
else.
Did. They had even the social media photographs from their holidays and everything. They had the whole lot, like. But anyway, that was really an aside, just to kind of give an idea of what was happening south of the border as well at the same time. So with these Colin Duffy, Fitzsimons and McCrory, is it?
Yeah.
McCrory, tied up with this case and all that went with it, McFadden infiltrated a kind of a younger, less experienced grouping, or maybe just not as...
He knew who to approach. So he had, McFadden had a bar that was built on the side of his house, and a lot of the sort of Belfast dissident Republicans, people who would, you know, you'd have knew their names, would have sat drinking in this house and in this bar. And clearly this was also wired for sound by MI5. And he knew who to approach, the gullible, you know, the agents that were taken in by this guy who they thought was great because there was a bit of money about him. Clearly it was a bit of money about him. He was working for MI5. And he appeared to have all the answers and be able to solve all the problems. But interestingly, he never even attempted at any stage to try and befriend any of these three people because he thinks that he would have known that they had a sussed out quite quickly, that there was something not right. He claimed to be a hotel safety inspector to account for his very long absences away from his Glengormley home. Prior to that, he had already infiltrated or joined Sinn Féin in North Antrim. There were suspicions raised straight away because at the time he was living in Carrickfergus in a very loyalist estate. And they're going, why is this boy even trying to join Sinn Féin? He claimed to them that he was an Aer Lingus airline pilot, but one of the Shinners had a daughter or niece or something who was an air hostess for Aer Lingus and was able to check and say there's no pilot on him, works for Aer Lingus. Before that, when he had first arrived in Belfast, going back over 20 years ago, he had actually tried to infiltrate loyalist groups who were involved quite heavily at that time, the very early days of the importation of ecstasy and the rave culture. And a lot of the UDA were behind a lot of that. He tried to infiltrate them and he told them he was a former member of the Parachute Regiment. So he'd had several different changes of character over the years. And despite, you know, I have been told afterwards that some people did say, there's something fucking dodgy going on there. But they were told, you know, be quiet. Dennis is a good guy.
How long was he recording them? So say, was it the same timeline as this trial was lurching through the courts?
No, he infiltrated them quite heavily and was a senior member of SIR and had been organising things. But this, the actual sting, he had hired two houses in Tyrone and one apartment in Edinburgh and they were all bugged. And the difference between that case and this case is... this case fell down on the quality of the evidence from MI5. So very grainy CCTV, really, you know, audio that could barely be heard. You could barely make out what people were saying. Loads of background noise and things going on in the background. This is different. It's like they learnt their lessons almost from that case. And in this case, it was in enclosed houses. It was in, you know, big bungalows were hired off like Airbnb or Booking.com. At one stage, he was so cheeky, he actually left a review for one of them. On the website, saying it's a great place, it was all right. Bugged in every possible way with both video and audio. And I know the people who have seen some of those tapes have said to me, it is like watching a Netflix documentary. It's so clear.
Right.
There can be no doubt over identification. Mm. Not only that, whenever they finish the meetings, if you have any kind of like IRA meeting, you would clear everything up and clean everything up. But McFadden went, just you go on. Boys and girls, I'll clear all this up. And so there's coffee cups and ashtrays and everything. And MI5 swoop and take all that. That's all covered in DNA evidence. That puts the people at the scene again. So while none of them have admitted yet, because this case is also rallying around in the courts, have admitted that they were at those meetings, I think they're going to have serious difficulty in trying. The only person who's admitted being at it was there was a doctor, Dr. Hassan Basalat, who was a Palestinian GP working in Scotland. He had came and spoke at Sarah Ardesh's over the years. He claims that he was completely entrapped by McFadden.
Where is he now?
He got bail because he had a bad heart and he's back over living in Scotland. But what he says was the most bizarre story, that he needed passports for his children and they weren't coming in time. And then they says, well, you can pick them up in person from the passport office in Belfast. I don't know why. And then McFadden comes along and said, I want you to speak at this meeting and sure, I'll pay all your travel and we'll get you somewhere to stay. And he booked him some sort of apartment somewhere down beside Queen's University. We're told that he said, I have my children with me. I can't go and do that. And he went, oh, it's okay. I'll get someone to babysit. And some woman who was clearly also MI5 came along to mind these children and bring them food. And he thought he was going to go for an hour and speak at a meeting. I'm told that once he started driving into Belfast and he realised he was being taken miles away to Oma, he wasn't a bit toppy about that. He claims he only spoke about the conflict in Palestine and what was going on there. But there's also then, I think he's implicated in the fact that some of these people travelled to Beirut and stuff like that as well, prior to being arrested, and they're trying to,
it's
obviously
extraordinary.
So it is. It's
a, could you make a Netflix drama out of it if you tried?
McFadden alone, I think there's about four books in them. Yeah. You know, in mm-hmm. terms of that, there's definitely a drama in the trial when it's over. And all
and
of this,
so Colin Duffy and Fitzsimons and McCrory, for example, had they been involved in anything, shall we say? Because of course they've been acquitted of terrorism charges, but had they been, they would be mature men who would smell a rat.
I think so. I think that that was the way, that why they needed to get rid of them. You know, they needed to get them offside, because I think that if, I mean, this wasn't their first rodeo, do you know what I mean? And they'd have known, they've seen informants before within, you know, the provisional IRA, and how that's worked out. And I think that they would have sussed them quite quickly. You know, I remember talking to a fella, and he says he remembers seeing him walking past, Alec McCrory walking past, and McFadden seeing him putting his head down and disappearing in the other direction. You know, he didn't even want him to say hello to him, because I think he knew they'd assist him, and maybe his handler said to them, stay away from them boys, you know, these are the ones we want you to target, because
how long were they in custody
they're
for?
A bit thick. 27 months. I know I asked yesterday the solicitor for Harry Fitzsimons, said he'd been 27 months in custody, so you know, 2.5 years in
remand. And do you think being on remand, you know, on bail or whatever, would have kept them very
clean their bail
regarding
hearing,
what they were
their
doing?
Bail conditions were really strict. They all had curfews. I think they were all tagged. They were being constantly knocked up by the police during those curfew hours to make sure there was like constant bail checks on them as well. So, you know, once you were on those strict bail conditions, you were pretty much tied down. You know, there was no way
so
you
if
were
you wanted to go out in the piss on a Thursday night in Belfast, you'd have had difficulties sort of thing.
No, well, I mean, that's it. You'd know I wasn't going to bump into them anyway. That was one thing. But yeah, so they were on strict bail conditions. So it was a way of getting them out. And what we always say is when you're talking about these things, if you were trying to disrupt the activities of that group, well, what do? You take the head off the snake. And once you take the head off the snake, the rest of it's easy enough getting rid of.
So what are they, will they be feeling celebratory after this? Is it going to be a relief
to
them?
Much of
they...
There wasn't much of a reaction from them in the court, or there'd only a handful of people with them. It's my understanding that they told much of their sort of family and children and stuff to stay away, because they'd want them photographed coming and out. But the there wasn't much of a celebration. I've seen a few of the, you know, there's a few hugs exchanged, but there wasn't any, you know, whooping or hollering in the court. I mean,
they would
is,
have been men that could have done jail.
They would have done serious amounts of jail, because bear in mind, none of this is all after the Good Friday Agreement, so you're not getting any kind of reduced sentence. You now do 2/3 rather than half of your sentence. And the charges that they were facing, you know, in terms of the attempted murder and also the direct and terrorism charges, you could carry anything from, I think, about 13 years to life in prison. They were probably, realistically, if found guilty, looking at something, you know, between 10, 15 years. So,
are they the type that will sit down and talk to somebody about their experience?
Well, I did ask them as they were coming out. I asked Alec McCrory, and he just said, no, just you make sure you write the truth and that'll do you. Whether or not they will or not, I don't know. I did. Colin Duffy did speak to me before, after he was acquitted in Massarain. And I have spoke to the other ones, but I've never spoke to Harry Fitzsimons. But whether they will or not, I'm not sure. I think that, you know, given especially with Colin Duffy, the amount of tragedy that went on during this trial in his life, he probably just wants to get his head down. And I do know that none of the three of them are involved in Surah or that organisation anymore. You don't see them at any of their commemorations and everything. I'd say they're still quite staunchly Republican, but probably...
they've hung up their boots.
...wise and disillusioned to the activities that were going on within there. It was so heavily infiltrated. So yeah, I will say that if, you know, if that was the aim, well, then maybe it worked. And as I said, you know, before, MI5 don't care about prosecutions. That's
and
not their job.
And if it wasn't the PPS, I'm sure like the like our own doesn't have to give any excuse as to why they took a case or answer any questions.
The PPS have defended what they've done and said, you know, that it was in the public interest, that they believed that there was enough evidence there. But they don't trial cases. A judge does that. And remember, these are judge-only cases. You know, this is done in the non-jury system, so like the special criminal courts type system. So it was a judge. And judges are, you know, especially Justice O'Hara, they're very methodical, you know. And he clearly believed that while some of the evidence was circumstantially strong, that when all taken together, it just wasn't enough to convict.
The Diplock courts then are, I mean, like, that's a lot of time for the Diplock court to be taken up with that.
Yeah, and one judge as well.
And one we have two special criminal courts running at the moment now. And for the last few years, because of the level of organised crime coming before them, there has to be more and more organised crime cases now not relating to terrorism coming before those courts.
There need to be a change in legislation, because one case that you and I have spoke about before, the Lawler case, it would have been, if that had been running in the South, that special crime every day of the week, do you know what I mean? That's never getting a jury. But because the legislation for non-jury courts here specifies terrorism offences, they can't actually run non-jury cases in gangland killings, which is really difficult given the fact that, you know, this place is incredibly small and you're picking a jury from a very small population. So I would think that at some time, now that we have an assembly up and running again, that the Justice Minister may be looking at that legislation with a view to changing it so that non-jury trials can be used in non-terrorist cases. Because more and more as we move away, and there's less terrorism but more gangland style killings, you can see how there would be the need for that.
So, and the Lawler case, where are we at?
Oh, for goodness sakes, I would say.
So that's sitting around, it has been kind of
there was talk
busy with the bail.
October this year there was talk, but then obviously the charges brought against Jim Fields added another person, which meant then his defence is going to have to get up to speed with the entire case. That's probably going to delay it further. Realistically, maybe the start of 2025.
With the trials before jury?
At this point in time, it's going to have to go in front of a jury, because the legislation doesn't allow them to run it without a jury, because it's not a terrorist offence.
Well, funny, I mean, we're talking about this taking 10 years, 2020 when that happened, the arrests and the charges were levelled in.
And, you know, we always point to other cases in England.
4 or 5 years, really.
I mean, if you look at, you know, one of the cases, obviously, because of the documentary and everything, it's been in the media again this week, is the Sarah Everard case. I mean, we and cousins within a year, and that was such a complicated case in terms of the evidence gathering. No trial convicted. You see that all the time in cases. You know, there's cases, we'll maybe have a chat about them some other time, of police officers who are accused of quite serious criminality that have been rattling around the courts for eight, nine years, and they're still not concluded.
And are they still then on suspended leave, full pay?
I had written about three a couple of weeks ago, and of the three, one has been dismissed on something completely unrelated to what they're charged with. One took medical retirement after they were under investigation, which again is so suspect. Like, I've actually tried to ask the police how many people they allowed to retire while they're under investigation, and they told me it'd be too expensive to answer that FOI. So we'll maybe have to get someone at the police court to ask that for me. And the other one has been suspended on full pay that entire time.
Mm. It's a lot of state, you know, taxpayers' money going into all that, isn't there?
It really
is.
Yeah. You know, in terms of confidence in policing, it's really damaging as well.
Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot of analysis to do with that. And I mean, obviously, there's two main theories, that either it was a complete failure by the prosecution and the PPS.
It was a failure by the prosecution and a success by MI5, maybe.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Because, as I've said, MI5 don't care whether you're prosecuted or not. Their job is to disrupt the activities of these type of groups. And if that was their aim, well, then it clearly worked.
And finally, and, you know, people in the North probably know the answer to this fairly quickly, but where are the new IRA at now? How dominant a force are they?
Yeah, well, I mean, they have been completely disrupted and heavily infiltrated. But remember, you know, I suppose it's that old saying that used to say, you know, they have to get lucky every time, we've only to get lucky once. They were responsible, obviously, for the attempted murder of DCI John Caldwell last February. And that was the kind of shooting, we haven't seen that in a while, those sort of what they call up close and personal, you know, basically approached by two gunmen. He was very lucky to survive that attack. And that in itself, the prosecution case in that is just bonkers, because it involves dissident Republicans who have already been convicted previously of other dissident Republican activity, a loyalist family of a former UVF prisoner, and people who have been charged, you know, in terms of ATM robberies and quite serious drug offences, all thrown together. So you've got like Republicans, criminals and loyalists, and the prosecution claimed this was a joint enterprise between them all to take out a cop who they, you know, disliked because of the things that they investigated in the past. So if like that prosecution pulls off, that really will.
Not to use a motive in that case at all. Of course, you can take prosecutions without giving a motive.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, they're saying that this was a personal thing. It was a grudge against this. It wasn't just well, let's target a police officer. It was, let's target this very specific police officer. And as you know, there's a bloody cast of thousands involved in it. I think up until this time, we're up to like 13 people have been charged in connection with it.
So that was and obviously the Lyra McKee case is coming up as well.
Yeah, and that would have been, if what happened then and what happened with Dennis McFadden and Arbacia, and people say, why did they pull him out? You know, when they did, why didn't they leave him? You know, it has been said that Theresa May, after the killing of Lyra McKee, said, well, you know, called the intelligence agents in and said, what have you gotten these people? Right, get in there and disrupt. That's it. They're done. You know, get in and pull out what you do, whatever you can. And that was when the decision was made to pull McFadden out. But before he went, one last job, get these people at a meeting, get the meetings bugged, get them to implicate themselves. And that seems to have been what's happened there. And it did work in terms of the fact that there was nothing really happening, new area activity for a long time, right up until Caldwell, and then nothing's happened since. And obviously the terror threat's been reduced, so clearly their intelligence is that nothing's going to happen.
Was that seen as the last thing of a dying wasp?
I would never say never, because there is still quite, they do still have quite like a hardcore, I suppose, wee rump of support, but it's mainly based in and around Derry, Strabane. And you know, when I say even in Derry, it's almost down to one estate in Derry, it's almost down to the Craigan estate. But they do have support there, and you can see that on Easter when they have that big parade. There's a fair squad turnout date, you know, so you can't say whether or not how many of them are actually actively involved in planning attacks is different. But there are, there's definitely still a number of them who are still active, and we see that with like weapons finds and stuff like that. How effective they're going to be, considering that they seem to get caught every time they're trying to move. That's a different thing altogether.
It's all interesting. Well, Alison Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Chloe Domini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.